Good morning, everyone. It is 9 a.m. and time to, and welcome to our meeting and time to convene the regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUB on May 7th, 2024. I am Toni Olson. I'm Vice President of the Board. With joining me today is Commissioner Rebecca Wolf to my left. Scott Jones, Scott Jones, Chief Financial Officer, Colin Willenbrock, General Counsel, Melissa Collins, Commission and Executive Services Director, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, over far to the far right, and Morgan Stolzner to my right, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Commissioner Sid Logan is absent today. And before I begin the meeting, it is with a really heavy heart that I inform you that the PUD Commissioner Kathleen Vaughn passed away on April 21st, 2024. I just learned about it last night. Kathy served from 1994 to 2018. Wasn't that your first year? And she was the longest serving Snohomish PUD Commissioner in the last 55 years, extremely active and respected throughout the United States as a public utility commissioner. Additional information will be made available in a few days, but I do ask you now to join me in a moment of silence in remembrance of Commissioner Vaughn. Thank you very much. The written record, I've already introduced staff. The written record will indicate others who are present. Remember to mute or turn off your electronic devices during the meeting. This session is for the board and the CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and PUD staff. I will now turn it over to Chief Financial Officer Scott Jones, who will facilitate this part of our meeting.
Good morning, Commissioner Olson, and good morning, everyone. I am not John Harlow. John is traveling this week to the NERC meetings in Washington, D.C., so you have a poor substitute for a couple hours. First up is Aaron Sweeney for a communications update. Aaron.
Good morning, Commissioners. Aaron Sweeney, Lead Communications Specialist. Thanks for having me this morning. So media reports, so I haven't seen you guys in a while. It's been a couple months, so we've got a lot to go through. First up was the Energy Block Party. Received a lot of great media coverage on this, and the day was just fantastic overall. Just a great event. You know, we did a lot of marketing beforehand to get folks here, and I think it really paid off. Despite the rain, we saw a lot of folks here. I think it was better spaced out this year. We had the presentations added that. I think that this year was even better, and we hope to make it even better next year.
Very well laid out. Didn't seem, you know, was spread out, so we weren't so, felt so confined and official.
Right. Everybody had just
It
was a wonderful time.
I worked the EV car show a lot, and I just saw lots of people with smiles on their faces just walking around, and then lots of thanks as people were leaving, and it was great.
I was just stunned at that EV car show.
I know. I
never heard of some of those.
I was just going to say there were cars I had never heard of.
Yeah. And I think we had about 40 cars out there, which is about our max. And so Snohomish County EV Association helped us put this on, and they basically said this is the premier event in Washington now that a lot of people.
Oh, really?
We had people coming from Tri-Cities, other places far away to come to this event, so very cool.
That is a big surprise.
Yeah. So I'd be remiss if I didn't shout out a bunch of people on our team. Kelly Stickney, Laura Zorg, David Kruger, Wendy Paris, and Kelsey Weeby did a bunch of the design work. So just kudos to all of them. They did an amazing, amazing job. Yeah. And the district as a whole. We had so many volunteers this year. I mean, everybody pitched in, and it was just a really, really great event. Next up, rate increase coverage. We saw a bunch of this in March and April. A lot of it locally, but also we saw Seattle pick it up. Because I think it was seen as a modest increase compared to peer utilities, we didn't get a lot of kind of in-depth coverage, kind of more of the just kind of basic, hey, this is what's happening. I think a lot of things, we tried to lean into the messaging of that this is going to average $7 more per month, and we heard that a lot in the coverage, which was nice.
That's a great picture. I know exactly where it is in Edmonds. Third and Dayton.
We also had a groundbreaking for our new community solar project in Everett. Got some coverage from APPA and also some local coverage on that. We also had commissioners and electeds out at the groundbreaking itself. So that project will be being built this year. And I'm sure you'll hear a lot more about it as the year goes on. A lot of miscellaneous media coverage. We launched our tree program, got coverage in Linwood Today, Stanwood Camino, again, Public Power, a lot of coverage on that program. Kind of new energy technology. We had a story that Scott Gibson worked with an APPA reporter on that was about battery safety and kind of the all the work that we're doing around that, and that turned out to be a really nice story. And then Bill Truitt, who actually works for Snohomish County EV Association, wrote an editorial in the Mukilteo Beacon just about battery storage and what that means for customers and how they're going to have to be partnering with us in the future. So that was a nice editorial.
And he was a great teacher. I was guest speaker in one of his classes one time in Everett. Mm-hmm. He was just a wonderful teacher.
Where did he teach?
Science teacher. It's the one that has the wolf out front. Which one is that? Oh, yeah. It's a high school.
Jackson?
I think it is.
And then finally, solar energy. We had a nice feature on Shane Fry that Solar Washington did, just a Q&A. That was nice. And then we had a kind of a pro-solar editorial that we were mentioned in the Everett Herald. And I'd be remiss also to say that Fitch gave us an AA- rating. And that was a press release that they put out. We didn't see much media coverage on it, but that's just nice that they mentioned us in that.
Which is what we were, right?
Yeah. Publications, Current was all about Energy Block Party. Also had some nice stuff in there about helping those in need, promoted Project Pride and some of our other programs and our people. And then also talked about Building for Tomorrow, kind of talking about how we're working on the grid and all the projects that we're doing there. And that went out to customers in mid-April. And then we had a really nice story in an NWPPA bulletin in March on Lee Meyer Beyer, who came up from Clark PUD and worked with Jen Lee Marzolf and just kind of did a little bit of an apprenticeship. And the neat part about this was an article that we ran in 2023 on Women in Trades. Clark PUD saw that and actually reached out to Paul Kiss and our folks and said they wanted to send Lee up to kind of come up and talk to Jen Lee and go through that kind of apprenticeship process and learn a little bit more about it and what it's like. Cool. That's it for me.
Thank you.
A new game for Aaron. We're going to name random school mascots. Very impressive. Before we get to, Marie Barnes is up next, but before we get to that, we want to close the loop with you on a billing issue that we talked with you about at the last meeting. John gave you an update on a net metering billing issue that we had discovered, and it really came about as part of the technical work that we had done for the latest rate increase. We thought that fixing that issue was probably going to take a couple months at least. We ended up fixing it in about 2 weeks. When I say we, that had nothing to do with me. our IT group really moved heaven and earth to get the technical side of it done pretty quickly. And our customer accounting group moved very quickly to do a lot of quality checks and stuff. And so we actually got over that pretty quickly. And so the impact is just de minimis. We're moving forward now and we've got the billing system kind of set up again with in the way that we think it should be. So what we thought was going to be a bigger issue turned out to be something very, very small based on just a lot of really hard work from some folks to get that fixed pretty quickly. So a big shout out to those folks.
Now, have those customers been individually contacted or otherwise made aware?
Yeah, Aaron, if you want, you can talk about the communication plan. We had before and after a pretty robust communication plan.
Aaron Sweeney, lead communication specialist. So we sent out an email to all the customers, and that reached about 80%, high open rate, so we know a lot of them saw that. And then we also sent them a letter kind of explaining the situation and that we were working on a fix. We're just going to do that again for the same customers to tell them that the fix is in place. And kind of, we have some FAQs on the website. We have a sample bill that kind of walks them through what they can expect on those bills and what it's going to look like. So we sent that communication out. We didn't hear a lot back from them, so I think it was pretty clear for them what's going on.
Yeah, just for magnitude, we have about 375,000 customers. We have about 5,500 customers in the net metering program, and then we think probably about half of those at most, but, could have been impacted. So we're talking about something that is meaningfully less than 1% of our total customer base here.
Yeah, and because the fix is in place so quickly, I don't expect them to have that much of a fuss.
Anything else on that, commissioners?
I have none.
I have none.
Okay. Thank you. Next up is Maureen Barnes. Maureen, we haven't seen you in so long.
I know, it's probably been like 2 weeks. I don't know.
She needs her own embossed chair.
Yeah, I would like that. All right, so today's kind of a stellar day for me, and I'll just let you guys know. Since I started working here 6 years ago, I started on Linwood Recreational Trail, and my goodness, it's been 6 years and we're getting the final one in, so yay, yay, yay.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It wasn't just me, a lot of people. So the presentation is to inform you, the board, of the proposed 25-year interurban recreational trail easement with the City of Everett. We're going to outline the primary terms of the easement and answer any questions you may have regarding the transaction. The new easement will be brought to commission for a public hearing and approval by resolution at the May 21st, 2024 commission meeting. So a little bit of background. The trail follows the Pacific Northwest Traction Company, which is the PNT, former Interurban Electric Trail Corridor, which ran from Seattle to Everett from 1910 to about 1939 and spanned approximately 29 miles. When the district purchased the electrical system from Puget Sound Power and Light, the corridor had already been converted to a power line corridor. And in the 1990s, at various dates, Snohomish County and the cities of Edmonds, Mount Lake Terrace, Linwood, and Everett built an approximate 12-plus mile pedestrian and bicycle trail, which connected the 12 miles, which were through King County starting in Seattle, and it was called the Interurban. So in light of the many changes in the previous 25 to 30 years, it was essential that we drafted an updated interurban trail easement that would be put in place as these easements expired. The trail easement with the city was actually executed in 1994, and in 1997 they did a phase two, which increased it. Due to the expiration in 2019, extensions were consistently put in place with the City of Everett that we ensured that there was continuity. There was always an agreement in place, unlike a few other of our municipalities. The easement is a product of significant collaboration and cooperation, compromise between the city and district staff. So pretty much the terms, we're following what we did with Linwood, Snohomish County, and with City of Mount Lake Terrace, which is a 25-year easement. No modifications or changes to the trail without us reviewing and approving that. The trail is the actual paved portion extending 10 feet on either side of the center line, which the city will completely maintain. Any debris from dumping or transient camping outside of that footprint will be split 50-50 regarding cleanup. And that doesn't mean just one piece of paper, of course. It's larger, big cleanups that need to be done. The City of Everett is going to pay any costs associated with warning signage, bollards, or protective devices. Says the district will inspect and maintain any fencing or stormwater infrastructure that we have installed or have had installed upon the property. Any relocation of the trail or trail amenities is at the sole expense of the City of Everett, with the district retaining the right to request relocation as needed for system reliability and safety. So our next steps. The Everett City Council approved this new easement April 24th, and at the May 21st, 2024 commission meeting, we will be holding a public hearing, and at that time, commissioners can vote on that. Staff have reviewed and approved this request and the easement. The updated trail agreements have been put in place for City of Linwood, Snohomish County, and the City of Mount Lake Terrace. Edmonds has a perpetual easement, so that doesn't need renewing. The terms of the agreement are in alignment with the other updated trail agreements. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
I was just wondering, and great work on this. Really.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering about the proximity between the trail and the new light rail. Is there?
Don't know exactly where that's going to be, and I don't think it would be right next to the tracks. Usually they're elevated going over.
The tracks are, yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. But nothing, as you know, is kind of in memorialized yet.
I was just imagining somebody having a bike and hopping off the trail and getting on the train. <I don't know.
laughs> Or grabbing hold at the end as it goes by.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. That's all I have.
Any other questions?
I have no questions, just the comments. Kudos to everybody. This has been a slog.
Yes, it has. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Next up is Angela Johnston, who's going to introduce. We need to give a presentation here on the insurance renewal. This is typical for every year. We'll give you an update. You can get frustrated about the renewal increases. We'll all share that together, that frustration, and then we'll see where we move forward.
Well, actually, some of these didn't seem as bad as the previous years.
I agree. We'll thank the next two people that are coming up for that. Angela, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to, Angela Johnston, Senior Manager of Risk Management. I just wanted to take a moment because this will be the first time Kyra Farmer is in front of you today. She is new to the district. She started in November of this last year. So we gave her about 4 weeks to, you know, acclimate. And then we said, here, take over our renewal process. And I just wanted to give her some kudos. She worked very well with her new finance team. Specifically Greg Galliotti and Brittany Hightower-Peel. She's done an amazing job just integrating with us and getting out there and getting all of the information that she needs to make sure that our premiums stay at the lowest possible. She makes sure that the district's insurance and claims programs are running really smoothly, and she makes sure that she reviews all those contracts, that the programs themselves are integrated into the contracts well. So I'm really excited that she's here. I'm very excited that I did not have to fumble through the renewal process on my own. And so with excitement, I'm gonna pass it over to Kyra.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. Glad to be here. So as Scott mentioned, I'm here to brief you on the 2024-2025 renewal. And that's also going to include an overview of our insurance program as a whole, and then give you an update on the market. So no action is required today. We're just going to look at the estimates, the estimated premium, and then I'll be back on the 21st with a resolution that will have an updated premium chart that will have the close to final premium numbers. So our objectives today, I'll give you an overview of our renewal process. Go over the insurance program chart, we'll talk about the insurance market landscape. I'll share with you the premium estimates, and then we'll get into more specifics as far as the market for liability, property, and cyber. So this is the executive limitation that supports the insurance program. So as you can see, we're required to place $50 million in excess liability, as well as maintain property, vehicle, crime, and cyber. As you'll see on the insurance chart, we do have more coverages than those listed because of our operations. So this is an overview of the timeline of the renewal. So it's a six-month process that starts in January, and it starts with a renewal strategy meeting with our broker, similar to what we're doing today, where they kind of inform us how the prior year ended and then give us a heads up on the market and what to expect for the upcoming renewal. And then February, March is kind of a heavier lift. That's when we're reaching out to the various teams to collect renewal data information. So huge shout out to Greg Galletti. He is the senior claims adjuster for the district who helped me divide and conquer on this task. So it's quite a bit of a list. So there were about 12 applications that have various questions based on the line of coverage. And then there's tons of supplemental documents that we have to submit with the applications. And so I've listed all the different departments that we had to connect with on this. Huge kudos to those groups as well. I've done renewals at other companies, and this is the most collaborative and responsive group of business teams that I've worked with. So it really made it easy for us to gather the information that we needed.
Can I ask you about transportation? What does that entail? Is that like all of the transportation that we do, or is it when people are out in the field working?
Transportation would be more related to like our vehicle fleet. So we would provide like auto schedules and vehicle schedules so they can accurately price premium for our auto exposures.
Okay.
All right, so this is our program chart. This is all of the coverages that we have in place here at the district. The three that I'm going to highlight are the ones that we're going to talk about today. So the first tower is property, and we have a $400 million limit for our property program, and it's considered a quota share. And what that means is the five carriers that you see listed in the tower, StarTech, Munich Re, Aegis, they share a portion of that $400 million. And then we have a $1 million deductible. If we go over to liability, we have a $35 million policy with Aegis, and then we have another excess liability policy on top of that with EIM for $15 million. So that gives us the $50 million that we saw in the executive limitation. And then on our liability program, we have a $2 million SIR, which is self-insured retention, or you can look at that as a deductible. And if we skip over to cyber, which we're going to talk about here shortly, we have a policy with Aegis as well for $5 million limit with a $1 million retention. So now we'll talk about the insurance market in general, which will kind of speak to the premium increases that we're seeing. So it's probably not a surprise, but natural catastrophes have a huge impact still on the market. So they impact the market in two ways. They not only limit the amount of insurance available, but then it also impacts the rates and how much the available insurance costs. So you'll hear me kind of speak to this throughout. We have to consider the full landscape. You'll see that the district, we have really positive loss history, which means little to no losses, but the entire industry has to sort of bear those consequences. So the insurer has to find some way to recoup their losses that they pay out for these larger, more severe natural catastrophes. And one of the ways they do that is through premium. And so unfortunately, they can't go to just the subset of their clients or their insureds that have had all the losses. So they have to spread the love, and we all have to kind of share in those impacts.
Question on going back for a second to slide number six. Under excess liability, $35 million for wildfire aggregate. I remember in one of our resolutions in WPPA that we passed this year was to limit the amount that a PUD could be charged in a wildfire situation. And I thought it was like, I don't know, half a million or something, but this must be for individuals, not, I don't know who would be claiming wildfire damages. Do you know? Would it be individuals who are harmed?
Correct. So it could be an allegation of how we handled and mitigated that wildfire. They can make a claim as far as some sort of negligence. So they could claim that we have some liability to whether it's their property damage or even injuries.
So okay, thank you.
Mayor, if you don't mind, let's pause. Colin can probably speak to this with a little bit more information, because And it's probably good for him to jump in here for just a second. This issue has been an enormous issue for our region.
Yeah.
And there have been very specific claims, very specifically directed at certain utilities that have been gigantic. And we'll be mentioning those later in this slide. But Colin has been a little bit more engaged in some of the wildfire stuff from a regional perspective.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's something that we're actively working on. I sit on the Washington State Department of Natural Resources Utility Wildfire Task Force, which was appointed by Commissioner Lands Commissioner Hillary Franz. And so a lot of discussion at first were utilities being tagged with state liability for the mitigation costs associated with wildfires. And so Klickitat PUD, for example, got an invoice for $100 million. And so they started to look at, you know, what are some liability caps, and how do we start to understand the way that the two entities work together? Private plaintiffs can also be claimants for losses.
Yeah.
Tribal governments, impacts associated with reservation lands, they can be claimants.
Yeah.
And so as the risk continues to grow, as we've seen in California and other states, it's an ongoing discussion.
Yeah.
On how do we manage our infrastructure in terms of forest health, vegetation management, and also make sure that we're working with our state agencies, tribal governments, and the like. So a lot of these insurance companies are starting to look at ways to limit their coverage and making sure that we're meeting our standards of care and making sure that they can cover for potential losses. So it's an ongoing discussion. There's actually a group that's been formed made up of public utilities and investor-owned utilities looking at potential legislative fixes, looking at revisions to wildfire mitigation plans so we can be connected in the way that we do our planning efforts. So a lot going on in this space right now, not the least of which is insurance coverage and understanding those limitations.
Well, thank you for serving on that committee.
Yeah.
That's really important. Thank you. And thanks to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks, Kara.
Okay, so this is a chart that depicts natural disaster losses in 2023 that exceeded $1 billion. So that very last bar represents 2023. There were 28 natural disasters, and you aggregate those total, all of those losses combined, was $93 billion. So again, that gives you an idea of insurers attempting to recoup at least a portion of that through premium. And then I bulleted out the different types that fall in 28 losses, and you can see the most frequent was severe storms. Now this is the same information, but it's taking those 28 losses and showing you where they happened regionally. You can see Pacific Northwest is pretty clear as far as $1 billion plus losses, but it's still important for us to know what's happening in the rest of the country, because again, it has an impact on the insurance available and the rates of insurance.
Something interesting about this map and this chart, to me, when I looked at it, I thought, well, why aren't they showing all the wildfires that have happened? And it's because they didn't happen in 23, most of them. They happened in 2020 and maybe 2021. And so that kind of answered that. But in a different year, the wildfires of Washington, Oregon, and Northern California were enormous.
Right.
So I think it started in about 2020. Rates probably started going up and up and up. And now they're not going down.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so it's just more of doing what we can to mitigate so that we're not being charged above and beyond what the increases are.
Right, right.
Yeah, one quick comment. This is, as you know, this is just the $1 billion claims, but I mean, we had a wildfire just, you know, up by Diablo Lake just last year, right?
Yeah.
So they're out there, they're just not quite exceeding that $1 billion mark for the last couple of years, but they are becoming more and more frequent, for sure.
And the Mole Creek fire.
Yep.
Was huge. I don't know what, in dollars what it cost, but I know it was massive. And what's another, this is a very interesting chart to me, because if you look at where the concentration of most of our damages are, it's in those states where they refuse to admit that there was climate change. And the politicians, sorry, and And I'm not going to name which party or who, but that's part of it.
We get it, Commissioner.
For years, decades, they said, oh, there's nothing to this climate change business. And so I was angry then, and I'm even angrier now.
No, that's a very good point.
Because it's hard to, you can't fix that. I mean, it's right. Too late almost, you know.
Right, so I thought this would be helpful to share. So FEMA puts out a risk index that gives you more of a holistic view of risk for a particular area. So I included the link on the slide, but it's a really cool tool where you can look at the country as a whole. You can zoom in by state, and you can also zoom into county, which is what I have mapped out here. So what they're considering in this risk index is all natural disasters. They are coming up with an annualized cost, which is 12 months of estimated losses for, let's say, for Snohomish County. But then they're also applying socioeconomic factors, which are sometimes forgotten, and that can impact how long a loss lasts, how quickly you recover from a loss, how long your business is interrupted. So they're factoring in those along with the lost dollars. And so according to this index, with all natural disasters considered, Snohomish County is considered relatively high overall on the FEMA risk index. And this is the same tool, but what I wanted to do was pull out wildfires specifically. So it's the same tool, but you're allowed to filter by natural disaster. So this shows wildfire, the annualized loss, so estimated 12 months for Snohomish County with those same socioeconomic factors considered. And as you can see, we're considered very low on this risk index. But important to know that last year as a whole, there were about 55,000 wildfires that took place, and it spanned 2.6 million acres across the US. So this is our premium chart. It goes over each policy, and then I have the 2023 premium listed, and then the estimated premium for 2024. And the last column is the year-over-year change. So this gives you an idea of where we're going to land. The total 4.4 million at the bottom, we anticipate that's going to go down, but our broker is still negotiating with the carriers to get those final numbers. But right now we're looking at about a 13% increase year over year. But again, we expect that to decrease to some degree. So when I come back on the 21st, we'll have numbers that are closer to final. So liability. So as a reminder, that policy covers third party property damage and bodily injury. We have a $50 million coverage with Aegis and EIM. So the main things impacting liability premium are nuclear verdicts. Those continue to increase. And so nuclear verdicts are high dollar verdicts that exceed $10 million. So the more frequent those are happening, that's going to impact again how much we're being charged for the premium and how much insurance is available. Inflation is also a factor. Wildfires, as we've talked about, is also a factor. So what I listed out here were just some details on the market to give you an idea of some large losses that happened in our industry in 2023. And then I end each one with our loss history. And you can see here it's positive, no paid claims on liabilities since 2017. Same thing for properties. So this provides coverage for all of the district's assets. We have that $400 million in coverage. Inflation has a huge impact on property loss costs, so that is impacting the premium. The frequency and severity of natural disasters also has an impact. And so underwriters are getting more conservative with how much insurance is available and the rates. But it's good. A good thing for the district is there are a lot of insurers that are running into a capacity issue, which means they're not able to get the amount of limits that they're used to. So for instance, we have the $35 million policy with Aegis. It's some insurers are running into an issue where the carrier is now saying, hey, we can only give you $15 million this year. And so it forces them to have to go find the additional $20 million somewhere else. The district has not had that issue. So again, we do see the increase, but we're not feeling the impact as much as some of the others who have poor loss history. Cyber, this provides coverage for data breaches, ransomware, general cyber attacks, security incidents, etc. $5 million policy with a $1 million deductible. So The market is beginning to somewhat stabilize, but the public sector does remain a target for cyber attacks, so that's something to consider when the underwriters are determining the amount of premium. Our brokers shared a really interesting study by a company called Net Direct, and they did a 5-year study analyzing 9,000 cyber claims, and then they determined trends, which I have bulleted here. So one important thing is 98% of those 9,000 claims over that 5-year period were from small to medium enterprises, which are businesses that bring in less than $2 billion in revenue. So that's important to note. And then the energy sector is number 2 ranked across all industries when it comes to the average total crisis cost. Ransomware still remains the top threat, and then also business email compromise, which is the phishing emails, the training we get all the time, clicking on fraudulent links or responding to fraudulent emails. So those two remain the top risks at this time. And again, positive loss history, no claims since 2021 for the district. So I wanted to just share some bullets about what I'll be working on as we approach the next renewal. So our contract with our broker ends next December. And so we do have an obligation to evaluate that relationship before we renew the contract. We have the obligation to the rate payers. So that's something I'll start beginning to evaluate more towards the end of this year. I've also just joined the Large Public Power Council Insurance Working Group. And that's just different utilities across the country that get together and share ideas about how their insurance program is structured. We can bounce ideas off of each other as far as strategy, maybe come up with more unique options to insure the risk. So that just began, but that's something that I'll be continuing to participate throughout the year and hopefully can bring things back that are applicable to the district. Aegis, as you saw on the insurance program chart, Aegis is all over it. And so I want to work on building that relationship with them, especially with the underwriter. Just keep that transparency so they can be aware of what the district is working on and be well informed on what our loss control efforts are and our security measures, et cetera. We'll continue our risk assessment feedback program that happens every 3 years with Aegis. And then the last bullet, I want to sort of do a deep dive on all of the options and maybe even beyond that you see listed there. I think some of these perhaps were considered in the past, but I just want to take a fresh look and work with our broker to do a deeper dive to see if any of these options are plausible or if any combination of these options are plausible. If not, that's fine, but I think we should just do our due diligence to see what our options are.
What do you mean by captive?
So captive is a unique risk financing tool where there's different versions, but some captives come together and there's several insureds that contribute to a company and they form an entity, but then they have a manager, a third party that manages it. And so you're assuming less of the risk. So it's more pooled money together and you have a third party managing it. And so it's not you having to carry the weight of the full risk.
So we're exploring that as an option.
Correct.
How would that affect us?
Well, it kind of ties into more of the utility risk pool. It kind of works similar to that where, you know, we've discussed on the LPPC calls where a utility risk pool may be possible where some of us kind of come together to share that risk. So we're paying less premium and we have sort of a shared pool of reserves to pay out losses. So it would work similarly to like a utility risk pool.
Tara, let me, so one example that's somewhat similar to these concepts is the nuclear owners and operators around the country formed an organization called NEIL. The acronym is NEIL, but it's the Nuclear Energy Insurers Pool. And essentially, the only people that are participating in that organization are people that own and operate nuclear power plants. There are no other, you're not reaping the ebbs and flows of hurricane risk or wildfire risk. It's concentrated to that very particular type of entity and that very particular type of coverage so that then you can isolate those groups. They can manage that in a very particular way with that very particular kind of operation.
helpful.
All right, so I will be back, like I mentioned, on the 21st with a resolution that will have an updated premium chart, and we'll be looking for your approval to renew the policies by May 31st. And so we'll just continue to work with our broker to drill down those final numbers and come back in a couple of weeks.
Now, the you mentioned earlier D5, well, that is not for this year's renewal. It's
correct.
For consideration for future.
Correct, going forward, yep.
Any other questions? Thank you. That was
thank you.
Quite good.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Karen, thank you. And thanks to all of the people on row two over there who have been managing this. I, like Commissioner Olson, I agree. We were pleasantly surprised that the percentages were not larger than we saw. I'm hoping that they'll come down a little bit.
Well, increase isn't not good, but.
Nope. It's still a positive number.
Yeah.
Next up is Garrison. Garrison Marr is going to talk through our EPA power product analysis. Garrison.
Hey, thank you. Garrison Marr, Senior Manager of Power Supply, and here to talk about the product analysis kickoff. So we'll talk about the analysis we will do, not the analysis that we have done. So today we're just going to touch on some background and context for why we're doing an analysis, what that analysis would look like, and the general timeline for that. We'll touch on the scope and we'll touch on the next steps. For commission today, no decisions to be made. This is just an informational briefing, but just like all of our presentations, you know, we're here presenting the information for feedback, and that's very welcome. And we'll launch right into it.
I do want to mention that Garrison did a marvelous presentation during the PPCF meetings. It's really heavy, heavy stuff, heavy information, but he presented it very well, extremely well.
I really appreciate that. Thank you. I'll try not to be too heavy today.
Well, that's okay.
How about the future in terms of as we move into this?
Well, I'll be honest, it'll probably be heavy.
Well, in teaching, we have to break things down into small pieces for our students, so I appreciate that that's how you're doing it.
Yeah, good application.
That's how you're doing it. So.
And part of that's feedback from this board that y'all appreciate multiple installments, and so that's what we're attempting to do here. So let's start with why we're assessing BPA power products, and some of this won't be a surprise, but you know, in recent years, the district has been affected by wholesale market price volatility and wholesale market price exposure. So we saw that in 2023 when we had a $98 million market purchase spend. We saw that over MLK weekend in January where we had a $35 million market purchase spend. In recent years, we spent $30 million for an entire year. On market purchases. So those are some things that have changed. And because some of those things have changed in the operating environment, we're looking at all of the options that we have to reduce financial risk to the district on behalf of our ratepayers, right? Our mission is safe, reliable, affordable, environmentally sustainable power. So we really want to make sure we're thinking about affordability all the time. So we're doing multiple things, one of which is refreshing the short-term risk strategy. Peter Dauenhauer from Rates at Risk presented on that recently to this commission. We're also building a very large battery right now. That's another way to reduce risk by having, you know, additional storage for power inside the service territory that reduces our wholesale market exposure. So we're doing those things, but we want to do more in parallel just to look at all of the options and find the best path for the district. EPA has opened up a product switch window that would start October 1st, 2025 for those utilities that elect to participate in that window and decide that they do want to switch products. So the district is conducting analysis to see if a product switch could be appropriate for us. So a little bit more detail on that, right? We are a block slice customer right now for BPA power. A block product, which is firm energy. Slice product, which is a share of the federal system, which varies year to year based on hydro conditions. The district would evaluate whether a switch to the load following product might have value for us. And in that product, BPA uses the federal system to match federal output with our load.
I'm trying to understand how slice is different from load following, because they both depend on fluctuations in the supply.
Yeah, so I do have a couple slides later in the deck.
Okay.
And I'll walk through each one. And
okay,
if there's questions after that, then let me know and we'll make sure that we throw right into it.
Okay.
The district is also looking at multiple things for our long-term future, and this is part of that. So for the commission's awareness, about 1,600 megawatts of our 1,900 megawatt transmission portfolio expires in 2026. When that transmission expires, we will have a choice to make of what transmission product we want. One transmission product works best for block and slice, but it is harder for other products. Another transmission product works okay block and slice, and it works better for a broader cross section of products. So we are already in a position where we need to be evaluating power products because of how they need to work with the transmission portfolio. At the same time, as you're all aware, we do our IRP, our long-term power plan, every 2 years. We already kicked off that process, so we're already thinking about the next 20 years. At the same time, we are also negotiating a long-term BPA power contract. All of these things have to work together, but this is an opportunity to align some of those things together as well. This analysis can materially inform all of those other processes, whether it's a yes switch or a no switch, that helps us with these other processes to know what that future could look like. So you will be seeing a lot of information about all of these different elements, but right now we're just talking about this product switch window in 2025.
What do you mean by price excursion market?
Yeah, so
I've never heard that put that way.
Yeah, so right now the power market, the wholesale price environment, it's vacillating somewhere between $80 to $100. But in a price excursion where demand and supply are out of equilibrium, you can get prices as high as $1,000. Over MLK weekend, we saw prices in the 900s. That's an example of a price excursion. We saw it with the Enbridge gas pipeline explosion a few years ago where there was supply disruptions. Those price excursions are becoming more frequent, and exposure to those price excursions is just a material risk we have to manage. So that's why we're looking at it based on the recent past. But of course, there's also the near future that we should be thinking about as well. The first two boxes there in 23 and 24, I described just a second ago, right? Higher market purchases in 23, higher market purchases in January 24. That's where we are basically up to today. But we have some other things that we need to think about as well into the future. The star on that timeline is where a potential product switch could take place if we were to make a product switch. The green box, rather, after that, are all of the big and material things that'll be part of that operating environment that we need to think about. So I described the box below 2026 just a minute ago about that transmission portfolio decision. Below that, you can see that EDAM, which is California's extended day-ahead market, is set to launch. That could take PacifiCorp and Portland General Electric, who have announced their intention to join that market and their supply into California's market primarily. And because, right, our price excursions are often caused by imbalance between demand and supply, that loss of supply could be material for us in the Pacific Northwest. And 2026 will also have a part of the CETA, or Clean Energy Transformation Act, that deals with ensuring that coal is excluded from retail rates. It has a provision that makes it difficult to transact for multi-month forward transactions. So a forward purchase from the wholesale market of, say, December and January, you know, a few months in advance of when December and January occur. That's material for us because that is one of the ways that we reduce our exposure to the day-ahead market by buying in advance for seasons of need. So that's something that the region needs to figure out. But right now, we expect that that market will be a little bit thinner because of this policy provision that makes it more difficult to transact there. 2027, we expect the Western Resource Adequacy Program to bind, which means utilities in that program will have penalties if they do not have enough capacity to meet that program's requirement. Expect that will cause utilities to hold more supply to meet those requirements. That will also be a material impact on supply on a forward basis, which is how we mitigate our risk of exposure to that day-ahead market. 2028, marching down the timeline here, it's possible that all of WEC or the Western Interconnect is in some form of day-ahead market, whether that's Markets Plus or the extended day-ahead market. That will also have some new rules for the supply that utilities need. It will also likely reduce some of that forward bilateral transaction for sourcing electricity from that market. And then we would expect some of the discounts for non-compliance with the Western Resource Adequacy Program be significantly reduced, so full penalty exposure at that point. So these are all changes in the operating market. They create some different challenges, also some different opportunities, it should be noted. But they're one of the reasons as well that we need to be thinking about what are all of our options to manage risk, to manage our portfolio, to set us up for success in the future. We have a new BPA contract in 2028. We'll have all of the CETA regulatory requirements hitting in 2030. And we expect that the inflection point of our electrification load growth, which is manageable, in our forecasts for the next several years, to hit an accelerated cliff with more load pressure into the early 2030s. That's the operating environment. Those are the risks that we want to manage. And so it's important that we think about all the options, all the things that we can do.
So one of the factors that affected that $40 million excess was transmission problems with transmission. Shutdowns here and congestion and things like that. So that further complicates things, doesn't it?
It does. It's one of the reasons that we need to make sure that our power product and our transmission product are aligned and that we have a good, solid, long-term plan for transmission adequacy, yeah, along with power supply adequacy. So that's why we're looking at this, right? And now we'll start to talk about the slice product, the load following product, what those are, and then we'll start to describe how we'll assess this. So just as a refresher, the slice product, the product that we have today, it's an advanced sale of a percentage of the federal system output. It's 5.44% specifically. of that output for Snohomish PUD, whatever that output looks like. It's paired with the block product like we talked about, which is firm energy. And one of the positive things about this is we know what our BPA bill for power looks like a year in advance, right? The BPA bill is fixed. But what that output looks like can be very different. So our market purchase and our market sales totals, that's what varies with the block slice product. And we take on that risk as customers of the block slice product. We have to make up any gaps left behind. The upside is we also have fuller access to surplus. So we sell that into the market. That becomes revenue for us. That revenue helps keep our costs lower. It does help with our wind integration because we can move up and down our slice allocation, which is a positive thing for us with the 217 megawatts nameplate of wind that we've had over the last several years. But we are also responsible for our own RAP compliance under this product, which is different than some of the other products. And we're still working on product compatibility with organized markets. That is that presentation that Commissioner Wolf referenced. That's part of the proposal that we've developed as part of the planned product group, which we helped establish, that represents about 43% of Bonneville's load, a coalition of customers there. So we're still working on that.
So when you talk about administrator, just you're talking about the BPA administrator, right?
That's correct, yeah. So other product types, they do have access to surplus, but it's different. It's the forecast surplus that Bonneville thinks it will get. And if surplus revenues are in excess of that, then Bonneville, at its discretion, can decide to use that for reducing rates for customers, for paying down debt, or for funding other programs like Fish and Wildlife. And in the last rate case, they did have more surplus, and they did do all three of those things. But one of the things they did not do is give all of that surplus to customers in the form of rate relief. Slice customers got all of the surplus, were able to monetize that and effectively use it for rate relief. So that's the slice product. The load following product is different. So in this product, BPA takes on all load service responsibilities. So there is not a gap left behind for a customer who takes this product to fill with the wholesale market. That's one of the fundamental differences. You do get billed for energy and capacity. So how did your load show up on an average monthly basis? And how did your peak load show up? Those are the big billing determinants. Those bills are not known in advance because we don't know exactly what our load will look like in advance. So we don't have variability on wholesale market purchases and sales, but we do have variability in our BPA bills. You have to pay an additional cost to integrate non-federal resources that are brought to load, things like our PUD hydro. We chose to bring our wind to load, that would also incur additional charges. So that's something that we need to think about. On the flip side, BPA takes on all the RAP obligation. Today, they do that at no additional cost. Almost certainly will not be the case in the future, but that's part of this contract negotiation. And this product would be dispatched through future organized markets. BPA has already established that position.
So is this part of the strategy to force BPA to go with more of the organized markets? Maybe not, I don't mean that in a bad way, but it would, wouldn't it? Or let's shall we say motivate.
I think for us, our strategy overall to help BPA design the best suite of products possible, because our industry is changing really fast.
Yeah.
And what the best fit for us today is, if the operating environment changes significantly, may not be the best fit for us in 10 years. And so what we would really like is to have only good options to pick from through this contract negotiation, not just for the choice that we'll have to make to start the next contract, but also if we have an opportunity to change products within the term of that 16-year contract. So that's really what our strategy is, and we think an important part of that is that all products work well with organized markets, since we expect that's the operating environment that we'll be in.
Well, to my knowledge, BPA is not, is BPA working with organized markets at this time?
Yeah, they're in the beginning stages of that. There's actually a workshop this week that'll talk more about what their plans are and how they see that from an operational perspective. But they haven't gotten all the way there yet, which is fine because those markets are not yet stood up as well. So those are the primary differences, right, between these two products. So it's different wholesale market exposure, right? The variability comes from different places. Block slice comes from wholesale market. Load following comes from load and BPA bills. There's other material downstream things to look at in terms of markets, in terms of RAP, in terms of non-federal resources. We, of course, always want to do an excellent job with clean energy and carbon, so we need to look at those things as well. So you start to get a sense of what should analysis look like. And that feeds right into our analysis scope and next steps. And if you'll allow me to be melodramatic for a moment. We spend $240 million on BPA power per year, about $40 million on transmission and ancillary services. And if we think about this product switch is just over the 3-year rate case, which is, that's the scope of it, then at minimum, this is about a $900 million decision. So we should do a pretty robust analysis, right? It's not back of the napkin sort of decision making here, which is why we've got a pretty big scope. So we would like to do 4 total studies, 3 quantitative studies, and 1 qualitative study. And that work is underway today. We'll talk about how that work is taking place and what that work is, but the 3 quantitative studies are really designed to look at what are the relative costs, values, and risks of the different products, really as measured in dollars. So this is a quantitative financial analysis. And there's a couple ways to do it, and we are essentially doing all of those ways. One way to do it is a look back analysis, and that looks at what were the actual rates, what was the actual market environment, what was the actual load, what was the actual hydrology. Look back a few years, calculate out how much was the block slice product, how much would the load following product have been, and that gives you one way to look at how would the world have looked different. That's good because all of those variables are known, but that's limited because the number of observations in that study, the number of years, is going to be a pretty low sample count. So it doesn't give you a sense of the full range of what could be, and it's really specific to those years that occurred. So it's not appropriate from our perspective to just do that. That's why we also have the look forward analysis. That look forward analysis would look over the 3-year rate case, so fiscal year 26, 27, and 28, and it would look at the known product and contract variables. We know what those are, right? We know what the slice block design is, what the load following design is, and how those are billed for, but we would look probabilistically at a range of 65 climate change adjusted weather traces to look at what are the full range of possible costs under block slice and under load following to see what the range of cost, value, and risk expectations would look like over the next 3 years or the term of this product switch analysis. So that gives us richer information about some things that are maybe tails of what could occur in a P50 based on a broader set of hydrology and load. So that's good, but it's still not perfect, which is why we have the third quantitative study, and that says, let's look out over the 2026 to 2045 period, which is generally the same period that the IRP looks at, and look at the long-term costs, values, and risks. We can bring in things like our regulatory environment over that bigger period where CETA kicks in and other things kick in, and take a look at how that affects our long-term strategy. So at the end, a look back analysis with dollars and cents, look forward analysis over the rate case with dollars and cents, and a long-term analysis with dollars and cents. Some people would say, that's a lot of analysis, surely you're done, but there is more that we need to do. Because some of the things that are important for this decision making are not dollars and cents, not exactly. So we also need a way to capture the other things that are important for decision making, risks and opportunities that can't be measured in dollars. So for that reason, we've developed about a 30-member team of cross-functional subject matter experts from across the PUD to identify what those qualitative criteria are that we should be looking at, what the differences between the two products are, and what makes them better or worse, each product better or worse across those categories. So there's a lot that falls in here. You know, whether it's financial processes, we just had the All-Star Row 2 here talking about some of those things, right? What our staffing would look like, what our strategy for clean energy and carbon would look like, what our customer goals would look like, things like that. So there's a lot that'll fall into that bucket. And in totality, those are the four studies that we plan to do. And we are making significant progress on all of them right now.
Can you examples of other qualitative analysis? Give me some examples.
Sure.
What do we look at?
So maybe just picking on row two here, since they're the closest row to me. In financial processes and systems, there are some interesting things that don't really show up as a bill. For example, how would credit rating agencies view different power products? What about resource portfolio diversity or concentration? That's not necessarily a quantitative thing, but it's something that we should think about. Our liquidity needs, cash liquidity needs for monthly variability. That's dollars and cents, but it's really a process and a system that we need to think about. So those are the sorts of things that we would try and capture in qualitative analysis.
Also, would you include like legislative unpredictability?
We could. So
I mean, that would be a qualitative thing, wouldn't it? I mean,
we do plan to have
things that are new, like CETA and all of those.
Yeah. So we do plan to have a category there, which is kind of the flexibility of the product to meet future needs. And that's really talking about the flexibility to meet regulatory requirements, both those that are known and those that may not be known. We sort of know the categories that they'll be in, like clean energy and carbon. But how those show up is something that we want to think about.
Is this, are there examples in the industry where other utilities have gone through this kind of multifaceted analysis?
There are. None of them are quite as high maintenance as ours. but, so last rate case, there was 6 EPA customers that made product switch requests. 4 actually switched, 2 did not. And so, you know, by talking with those peer utilities, got a sense of how they approached it. Most did a pretty simple quantitative analysis. Some are planning to do exclusively qualitative analysis with little to no numbers associated with it. So the approaches are really different out there. For our decision makers, we really want to do a robust job and make a holistic decision based on the totality of the information. So that's the what. We've got a how and a when to talk through here. So we'll start with a little bit of when. These are the deliverables that you can expect, and we're working through these. The look back analysis would be first. We have a draft that's under review from the peer review team now. Look forward analysis, we're still cooking, but it's we've made some good progress there. Long-term strategy analysis, we expect to take the longest, and we expect to do that after the first 2 quantitative studies are done. And we've made headway on the qualitative study, but we're not quite there yet. What we'd like to do is provide some incremental briefings to the commission as some of these are finalized through a peer review and they feel, you know, solid. So that's what we'd like to do instead of build these all up.
We need it.
Yeah, we don't want to dump 4 studies on you all at once. Here's the process that we expect to use. So we've formed the peer review team that I mentioned. It's about 30 folks. You can see the departments that are represented there. We've scoped the analytical details, which is that second box. We are in the process of performing analysis, and Power Supply is taking the lead on the quantitative work. And then that work is reviewed by the peer review team and a third-party reviewer. The qualitative work is really cross-functional, and we're doing that all together as one group.
So is the third party outside the utility?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're working through that now to identify who that will be.
You mean a consultant or a
Yeah.
But they're not going to drive their ideas. We're going to have them analyze our work.
That's right. They'll sort of be our fact checker. So they'll make sure that the math is correct and appropriate. And they'll have an outside perspective on the assumptions that we'll use in the models to make sure that they're balanced and appropriate too. So we want to use an expert so that it's not just driven internally. You know, we just want to make sure the best information comes forward.
They don't drive it.
That's right. So we're talking with some folks that have done these studies for other utilities.
Yeah.
And we think that would be helpful to have that experience too. Ultimately, we will have 4 studies peer reviewed, third party reviewed, and that will go to decision makers to set a course for what's next. So we'll go through the ELP to make sure that executive leaders here have an opportunity to weigh in and provide their perspective on what the totality of the information says, and then we would bring that to the commission. We'll be bringing studies forward as they are finalized, so you'll see the information, but not necessarily like the recommendation until the very end. That way, it's not all dumped at once and harder to work with.
What's the decision point?
The decision point we expect will be in October of this year. So that's what we're working towards. But because we have so many other processes in play, we'd really like to do a lot of the analysis here in the spring, so that as we work on things like our transmission contracts, scoping the IRP, participating in BPA post-2028 contract negotiations, that we have the benefit of that analysis to look at what the drivers of financial value and risk are. So that is the path forward, and we will continue performing the analysis across the deliverables that we talked about. We'll be working to secure that third-party reviewer. We've got this peer review team that meets every Monday and is looking at everything that's being generated. And then we'll come back with some incremental updates as, you know, we have things that are ready to be talked about. And that's it.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
Any questions, comments, Commissioner?
No, I mean, not at the moment. Really, I find all of this fascinating and challenging, and I'm really thankful for the team that we have under your leadership.
We've got a great team, and yeah, there'll be some good conversations for sure.
Yeah, smartest guys in the room, some of them.
A big sigh from me.
That's fair too.
I envision a lot of 24/7 work weeks.
Plenty of weekends, yeah.
This is a tough time, yeah.
But I have the opportunity here, just a closing thought. I do just want to reiterate that we have not made any sort of decision. We really want the data in the process to drive us towards decision making. So I wouldn't want anybody to infer that because we're standing all these things up that, you know, it's because we have a specific end goal in mind. We need the data to let us know what's appropriate. The discussions
like,
we'll have.
I would like your perception or opinion about something I heard at PPC or PNUC, I think it was PPC, and that was that a lot of people in PPC were not happy with the seventh power plant of the council. He's doing Northwest Conservation. He's at PNC, anyway, Pacific Northwest Conservation Council. And now they're working on the eighth power plant. And I heard that PPC people believe, no, that they believe that the people who are working on the eighth power plant are realizing that there were some things that they were not on top of, and that they hope to do a better job on the eighth power plant. So are you're plugged into that too, I presume?
We are.
To some extent.
Yeah. So Landon Snyder, who really does a lot of the quantitative work for us on our IRP.
Who is that?
Landon Snyder.
Oh.
He serves on multiple committees at the council. Those committees essentially generate the inputs for the power plant. So our
right.
participation is really making sure nothing crazy kind of goes into the machine, so we don't get anything crazy out of the machine there. But you know, the council has new staff. They're smart folks. So we're really optimistic about what the next power plant looks like.
Good. I'm happy about that.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Garrison. A shout out to Garrison and a lot of the folks that are working on this. This is a really, really big lift, just to echo Garrison's point from earlier. And the PUD is very lucky to have a lot of really, really smart folks sitting around the table looking at a big decision like this. And so appreciate Garrison being so thoughtful about the process. Anything else?
Okay.
I think that's it from us this morning.
All right, thank you. It is 10:18 a.m. and the meeting is recessed. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m. Thank you.